Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Juror 13 Show and Blog Talk Radio. My name's Denny Griffin. For the next hour, I'll be your host. And we're going to be talking tonight about some Black Widow cases with our guest, journalist and author, Lisa Sweetingham. And Lisa has been a correspondent for Court TV and now in session. And she has a novel out recently released called Chemical Cowboys. Lisa, welcome back to the Juror 13 Show.
Hi, Denny. It's great to be back.
We were just chatting a moment ago about how quickly the summer's gone. This is our first show of the fall already. Can't believe how fast it went by. So, Lisa, we're going to talk tonight about the three cases, that the so-called Black Widow cases, and they're going to be the Julia Turner case. We also have Susan Polk. And the last one we're going to finish with is the lady, well, I won't go into too much detail, Cynthia Sommer. It's a California case about a lady accused of killing her Marine Corps husband. So we've decided that we will start out with the Turner case. And Lisa, if you would be so kind as to explain to us what transpired in the Turner case.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, this is a special case for me because it was my first trial for Court TV where I went to travel to cover a trial from gavel to gavel. And Julia Lynn Turner was a 911 dispatcher who lived in Georgia, Cobb County. And she was married to a police officer named Glenn Turner. And in, you know, they married in 1993, and it was a pretty good marriage, it seems, except she liked to spend a lot of money. And, you know, about a year after, things got sour for the couple. And Julia started having, actually, she went by Lynn. Lynn started having an affair with a sheriff's deputy, a guy named Randy Thompson. And she actually started spending Christmases with Thompson and his family and buying gifts for his family. And it became pretty clear pretty soon that Lynn Turner liked to live a lavish lifestyle. And that her cop husband was kind of getting in the way of her plans. So they'd been married for about a couple of years when all of a sudden her husband, the cop, Glenn Turner, who's just 31 and he seems pretty healthy, he gets this terrible flu. And he can't figure out what's wrong, headache and flu and feverish. And he goes to the hospital, but they say, well, you know, they give him some medication and fluids and they send him home. Well, the next day, he's dead, and no one can quite understand why, and when they do an autopsy, they discover he has a bit of an enlarged heart, and so the coroner says, well, I guess that's what he died of, from heart failure. Now, Lynn had told all of her friends that the night before his death, she found him in the basement, acting delusional, in the middle of the night, and trying to drink gasoline and saying that he could fly. And that the next morning she gave him some Jell-O and, you know, a little bit of Gatorade, and he went on back to bed. And then she went out to go do her errands, and when she came back, she found him in bed and that he was dead. Well, in the meantime, she collected about $153,000 in insurance benefits, and days later she leased an apartment for herself and her sheriff's deputy boyfriend, who by now is becoming a firefighter. She also booked a cruise for them and their friends. She bought all sorts of sexy lingerie, and they're kind of cavorting around and having a great time. But by the end of the year, she convinces her firefighter boyfriend, Randy Thompson, to start the paperwork to make her the beneficiary on his life insurance policy. So as you can imagine, things are going along pretty much the same as they did with the cop. I think ultimately Lynn Turner gets bored with these men. And they have a daughter and then a son. And things aren't working out so well. They never got married, and she leaves him, but he still loves her. He still wants to see her. And in 2001, they had dinner together at a Mexican restaurant. And later that night, he goes to the emergency room complaining of a stomach ache and vomiting, pretty much the same as Glenn Turner's symptoms. So they treat him, and he's released. And she decides she's going to take care of him. She feeds him some Jell-O. Well, again, the next day, he's dead. The cause of death was put down. He's a very hefty man, and the cause of death was noted as an irregular heartbeat due to clogged arteries. And she received $36,000 in benefits after his death. But now, not everyone thinks that this is just fine and dandy. And in fact, Glenn Turner's mother, remember this is the first one, the cop, sees these newspaper articles about Randy Thompson's death. And she says to herself, wait a minute, what's the common denominator here? So she sends a letter to Randy Thompson's mother, and they start to compare stories. And then they contact the deputy chief ME of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, and they say, something seems really not right here. Now, the interesting thing about antifreeze is that if someone were to ingest it accidentally or by suicide, the first thing you feel is kind of silly and goofy and a little bit dizzy, like you would if you were drinking alcohol, because ethylene glycol is one of the main components, and it makes you feel like you're drunk. So it's very easy. In fact, they eventually did tests in a lab in Pennsylvania based on this case, where they put ethylene glycol, which is the principal component of antifreeze, in Jell-O, Kool-Aid, Gatorade, all sorts of other things, and it didn't change the texture or the behavior or the color of the food, and it would be very easy for someone to consume that without being suspicious, because many of them also have this sort of sweet taste, as you know, which is why it's very dangerous for animals. So pretty soon the investigators start to say, well, we have to look into this. So they actually go back and they exhume her husband's body. This is, he died in 1995. They exhumed it in 2001. So 6 years later, they exhume his body, which I got to tell you, the first mistake she made was she should have had him cremated. They find in his, they had actually kept the organs in a sack inside his body cavity. So it was pretty well preserved. So they retested, liver and kidney and other things like that, and they found this smoking gun. They were these tiny little, and they're quite beautiful, these calcium oxalate crystals that you can only see under, like, high-powered microscopes. And those crystals are the telltale signs of ethylene glycol. And they found the same thing in Randy Thompson's tissues. And then they knew, okay, this is not a coincidence. This is malice murder. And they took her to trial. Now, the funny thing about Julie Lynn Turner, and then I'll take a break here because I know I'm going on and on, but I just love this case. She was on house arrest during her trial, which meant she could come and go to court with her family. She had, she had a mom and a dad and a couple aunts who really loved her, and she had her kids at home. She lived with her parents. And so she would come and go from court, and she dressed very nice every day. She put on a dress and pantyhose, and she would sit next to me every morning, and I'm kind of like, the cub reporter. I'm not really sure what I'm doing at this point, but I know that there's a woman who's sitting next to me who's charged with, secretly poisoning two of her former lovers. So I'm very aware of everything she's saying and doing. But she would come and sit next to me and talk to me about what she thought of the previous day's story and what she thought about her case and what was going on. And the funny thing was that she loved to talk about what she was going to do when she was free. And what she really wanted to do was just go home and work on the cars, because she was an auto mechanic in her, not for money, but she was able to fix cars and work on engines. She liked to fix the pool in her family's house because her dad didn't know how to fix the engine. So it was very clear that she was very comfortable around things like antifreeze, but I don't think she realized how that was coming off. So that's my break for a moment to give you a chance to, digest some of that.
Sure. She apparently was somewhat shrewd, but that was quite a mistake, wasn't it, not having Turner cremated?
You know, that's funny because it's really the thing. When I look back at a lot of these cases, you know, a lot of these black widows, whether it's men or women, actually, if they've really thought this out, they go for cremation. And in fact, that came up later in the Cynthia Summer case, which I think is important, and I'll address that when we get to it. But yeah, if she would have had him cremated, they really would have had nothing on her.
Wow. Let me just give out our phone number in case anybody has a question or a comment for about the case under discussion or a separate question for Lisa. You can reach us at 646-478-0982, 646-478-0982. You know, antifreeze, now you say that it, one of the things is almost like drinking alcohol. You can act a little goofy, perhaps. And now these guys, Turner and the cop husband and the boyfriend, both ended up dying within a day, right? After, I mean, like they took one to the hospital and they thought he had the flu or something, and he was dead the next day. And the same
well,
thing
they
with
did.
Thompson.
Yeah, they both. What detectives and investigators believe that she did, I should say, obviously she was found guilty of murder, and it was in 2004. And the jury deliberated about 5 hours, but there were just so many similarities. She was convicted in the death of Glenn Turner, but they were allowed to discuss the similarities in the Thompson case, even though she hadn't been charged with that yet. And then in 2007, they brought her to trial for Randy Thompson, the firefighter, and she was found guilty of that, too. And she's now serving life without chance of parole. But back to your question, investigators believe that what she did was she gave them small doses over, could have been days or weeks, and that she kind of upped each dose to see, you know, until it really had its effect, and probably that she gave them a massive dose around the time or right before they ended up in the hospital, and then, like, you know, a final dose as a capper when they came back from the hospital in that Jell-O, or, you know, she would make margaritas for them. And you can imagine, I mean, a margarita already has that greenish look, so if you put a little antifreeze in there, it doesn't. But I just want to warn anyone who's listening, they will catch you, because there are telltale signs that antifreeze poisoning leaves behind. And at one point, her attorneys tried to claim that, well, Randy Thompson had been suicidal in the past, and if he died of antifreeze poisoning, he probably ingested it himself as a way to kill himself. That didn't really fly with the jury, and, you know, rightfully so. But there are definitely telltale signs, and I had actually about 3 or 4 months, maybe a little bit longer after that trial ended, I had an investigator call me out of Massachusetts, who said he was familiar with the Turner case, and he had read a lot of my reporting, and he wanted to talk a little bit more about the details of the case because he believed that he was on to a similar murder in a case that he had been investigating. So this has been done, not just with Turner, but it's been done in the past with other men and women who have tried to use this to poison their loved ones.
So the theory then is that she started out small doses, and then near the end, she increased the amount. And then after they had been taken to the hospital, probably administered the coup de grace.
Yeah.
And put them on. Did anybody say antifreeze? Just thinking about it, kind of gives me goosebumps. did it come out in the testimony at all? Would that be a very painful type of death, or wouldn't it be? Wouldn't it necessarily be a lot of pain involved with it?
Oh, absolutely, Denny. It's like, you know, imagine like the worst food poisoning you've ever had, except it doesn't end. And, you know, essentially their organs fail. It's like their body just can't handle it anymore. The liver fails, the kidneys fail, they have heart palpitations. It's just really a really horrific death. And the idea that she came home and, you know, oh, he was just dead in his bed, you know, he went back to sleep and the next thing she knew he was just dead. And his face was purple. Well, it was much, much rougher than that for him, I'm sure. So it's really, it's an awful, awful way to go. It's poisoning at its worst.
Did she testify herself at either trial?
No, she didn't, and I don't know that she wanted to. There were so many things she would have had to answer to in the affair and other and behaviors on her part, and she wasn't very genuine, you know. Especially since, you know, she was sitting there with me talking about how much she loved her kids and just wanted to go home and work on the cars and, you know, that all that stuff would have come out. I don't think she would have held up very well on the stand.
Do you think, Lisa, that she really expected to get off, like she would be talking to you about her plans that after she was acquitted? Do you think she really believed that? Did she really believe she was going to walk?
I think she did. I think a lot of these people, like her sociopaths, really believe that the world is theirs to choose to do as they please. I don't think she ever thought she would be in, you know, a prison situation. She didn't show any emotion that's not really fair. She told me before the verdict was read that she was going to remain stoic, and she did. She didn't show any emotion, and in fact, that was noted in a lot of the newspaper and online articles, is that she was expressionless, which, you know, a lot of times defendants are. I don't see defendants show a lot of emotion in many cases, but I did see her in a rare moment in the courthouse bathroom moments before she had to go back and they were going to read the verdict, and she was in there, and a girlfriend walked in, one of her girlfriends, and they looked at each other, and they hugged each other, and she started crying. And I thought, she must know. I mean, at this point, there must be something in her that knows that they only deliberated 5 hours. It's probably not good for her. So, but it still remains, you know, if you can poison both, you know, your husband and then the father of your children the way she did, so cold, I just think that's just sociopathic behavior.
When you talk to her, you know, when you saw her before proceedings and so forth, did she come across as a phony, or did she come across as a caring individual, or could you tell she was kind of a cold fish?
She was a tomboy. She was very, like, she wasn't so much a cold fish because she was very good at putting on that Southern charm. You know, we were in Cobb County, and it was a very small community outside of Georgia. I'm sorry, outside of Atlanta. So she had that good kind of, she knew how to do that kind of Southern lilt where, you know, everyone's honey and she could put on a pretty tone on her voice. But, you know, looking back, now that I've done a few of these things, it's like, it's very clear she was being manipulative and she really wanted to humanize herself to the press. And Court TV was the biggest thing going on at her trial. And there was a lot of other press there, but we were doing it live every day. And she knew that. And she knew that she couldn't get to our anchor who was covering the case. But she knew that she could sit with me and talk to me. And she started in the first day. And, you know, at the time, like I said, it was like my very first trial, and I thought, and I'm not really sure what to do with this. So I just tried to kind of, like, report some of the things that she said, but I started to feel the sense of, like, you know, well, I have to be fair to Lynn. But, you know, I mean, you always go in with the idea of this person is innocent until proven guilty, and you try to stick with that. But by the time they finish the prosecution case, you have a pretty good sense of the facts. And then when the defense case is over, and her defense case was, they did the best they could, but they didn't have much to work with. She had wonderful attorneys, but there just wasn't really anything they could put forward to dispute that evidence of those calcium oxalate crystals in both men's organs. And those crystals should not have been there. So anyway, she carried herself very well, but, you know, looking back, I can see now it was very disingenuous.
I meant to ask you, I couldn't imagine, you know, what the defense really could come up with. How long did it take the defense to put on their case? It must have been a fairly short defense portion.
Yeah, it was. I recall that it was about a day or two. It was very short, and it was really mostly a lot of character witnesses. Her mom testified, friends who loved her testified, mostly just to dispute accounts from other witnesses who said, oh, she wore a hot pink dress at her husband's funeral, and she was flirting with other men at the funeral, and you know, all those awful things that people always say about you when you're on trial for murder. So, but they did have one expert who tried to make the case that both of these men died from heart failure and not from these crystals, and that the crystals could have come from, you know, other sources. Like I think it's something you can find in, it's not cat litter, but there were other sort of like organic items that it was possible that it could have leaked into the crypt that Glenn Turner was buried in. But you know, it had have leaked into the crypt through his body and into the little bag containing the organs. And then, well, how, you know, and even in that case, well, then how did it get into Randy Thompson's body? So it was really, they just didn't have a lot to work with, and they knew that.
And you say she's life without parole, huh?
Life without parole, convicted in 2007 for the firefighter boyfriend's murder. So, you know, they actually could have gone for death penalty, but they didn't, which I think, well, you know, I'm opposed to the death penalty in general, and I think in this case in particular it makes sense because, you know, she has two kids. So you wouldn't want them to lose both a father and a mother.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that, you know, even though you had some thoughts, you wanted to be fair to her, to Turner. I'm just wondering, reporting in general, not this case in specific, but in general terms, you know, it seems to me that as a human being, you or any other correspondent or reporter, when you're covering cases like these, you can't help, when you're listening to the evidence and seeing the people and so forth, to form an opinion, but then I assume the trick is to keep it out of your reporting. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I think you have to always test your opinions. You have to always, like, I think it's okay to form an opinion because I'd be lying if I said that I don't have an opinion about something before I start to write the piece, because you have to think it through. But you always have to then test your own thoughts and test your own presumptions about someone or something, and try to find people who can debunk your theories so that, you know, you don't get tunnel vision.
Yeah, did you now that was your first case, and you knew that obviously right off the bat that your reporting had to be, what's this, slow enough, fair and balanced or whatever. But did you ever find yourself in any of these cases, I don't know if this is the right word or not, but disliking a witness or the defendant or the prosecutor, that type of thing? Did you ever really get emotionally involved in some of the cases or some of the people?
Oh my God, yeah, like every case. Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, Susan Polk, I would say, is a perfect example of a defendant who, by the end of that trial, I just wanted to throttle her. And, you know, she defended herself, and she was, boy. I can't, I'd have to go look, but that case, it was probably about a month long. It felt like 10 years. I mean, she took every single opportunity to pontificate, and she also was very, she was a very, like, meek, thin, gray-haired woman. She looked like someone's, you know, pleasant soccer mom, and older, a little bit older, but that woman had an acid tongue. And you know how vaunted the courtroom is supposed to be, and respect for the judge, and you know, the deputies keep order. Because the judge wanted to lay a record that there would be no reversal, or you know, or no error, She gave Susan Polk a lot of leeway in defending herself, and a lot of that had to do with Susan Polk's daily allegations of misconduct and bias that she lobbed at the judge, the prosecutor, the deputies, the clerk. She, every single day, probably about 3 or 4 times an hour, she would say things like, "The court reporter is falsifying the record, Judge, and I know because I didn't say this and I didn't say that." Or she would call the prosecutor names. She called him an immoral creep. She called him a lying, deceitful man. At one time, she called him a PE major. Like, just very, she was a very intelligent woman and extremely well-read. And so she had an incredible vocabulary and way with words. And she used them to verbally battle with everyone in that court. In fact, at one point, she even accused me, a reporter, of getting leaked information from a deputy, which was not accurate. But she was one of those defendants. Yes, that by the end of the trial, I just wanted to kill her myself.
And what exactly did Susan Polk do or get charged with doing?
She was charged with stabbing her husband to death with a paring knife. And she had an interesting story because she was only 14 years old when she met her husband, Felix Polk. He was her therapist. And at some point, you know, it was the 70s and free love and est and all of that sort of nonsense. And she came from a broken family, and she didn't really have a good father figure in her life. And Felix Polk was this kind of very, handsome, intelligent, Jewish American immigrant who swept her off her feet, really. And he divorced his wife and married her when she was 24 years old. So let's see, there was about 30 something years difference in their relationship. So in any case, they had 3 sons. They had a very bucolic life in Orinda, California, which is this really beautiful woodsy upper class neighborhood in Northern California. But she would deny this, and most of her trial was spent with her not so much defending herself from murder, but defending the many accusations that people lobbed at her that she was mentally ill. But she her delusions got more and more charged as she aged, and by the time she was like 40-something and her husband was 70, they were going through a terrible divorce. He had moved into a pool house on their property next to this pool. It was a nice little cabana. And they got in an awful argument one night, and she stabbed him to death with this paring knife. And it was funny because in trial she later called it, "Oh, it was everyone's favorite knife. All the boys like to use it to cut their steak, and I would use it," you know. And she basically, when she did this, she actually like washed the knife and put it back in the drawer, you know, so everyone could use it. It was nuts. But this is a woman who she had gone through 5 different attorneys, and she turned on each and every one of them. First she charmed them, and then she decided they weren't doing a good enough job and she would fire them, and she was finally allowed to represent herself. And her trial began, it was just, when was it? 2006. And the big story out of this case that was so fascinating was that her children were quite divided about her innocence. Her oldest son, who was a UCLA, I think he was a English major, his name was Adam, he was 23, and they all took the stand, 2 of them against her and 1 of them for her. So Adam, the eldest, who had to become sort of like the father figure to his brothers, laid out a very strong case for why she was, as he called her, cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. And she actually had to question her own son on the stand, and it was very tense. Her youngest son, Gabe, also was against her. He was 19 when he took the stand, and he called her delusional and a killer, and he said that, you know, she had these growing obsessions about killing his father, and she would make jokes about wouldn't she be happier if he wasn't around. Now, I should back up a little bit. When all this happened, initially she denied knowing at all what happened to him. She didn't know how he got killed. She didn't know who stabbed him, and it was obvious that it was her. And then eventually, and she was put in prison, and she stayed in prison. Eventually, she started to say it was self-defense and that they got into a fight and she was defending herself. So the only person who backed up that claim was her middle child, Eli. And they had a very strange relationship. She had this kind of, like, I don't know. Do you remember Kenneth and Santi Kimes?
Yes.
How Kenneth was just enamored of his mother and his mother was the love of his life.
Mm-hmm.
This was the relationship with Eli and Susan Polk. And, you know, Eli said that she was wonderful and she'd been a battered wife. And there was no evidence, actually, that her husband had ever hit her or laid a hand on her. In fact, it was Eli who had been arrested at one point for pushing his mother. And, in fact, Eli, when he took the stand, he was serving time for misdemeanor battery of a girlfriend. So, obviously, a really screwed-up family. But it was fascinating because, you know, her husband was not the greatest guy. You know, here he was seducing his teenage client. But they married, and eventually all that went away. And a lot of people argued that she had always kind of been a prisoner in their relationship, and that by the end she stabbed her way out of it, and that was how she dealt with it. Now, I should just obviously tell you the final chapter in this. I mean, there are a lot of interesting characters who showed up in court, but what ultimately happened was that she was convicted of second-degree murder. The jury struggled. There was one juror who thought that it was self-defense, and he did not want to convict her. But all the others tried to point out to him, look at this evidence, look at the way she says she held the knife, look at the knife wounds. There were 27 stab and incise wounds and also blunt force trauma to his head. And so this one juror finally said, okay, I agree with you, but I'm only going to second degree. So she got 16 years, and she'll be eligible for parole in 2017.
Wow, I wonder, I don't, you know, getting back to her defending herself, she was allowed to. Now, did the prosecution or the court try to talk her out of it, or were they willing, eager to have her be her own lawyer?
No, they did not want her to be her own lawyer, and they knew how long it was going to take, and they also knew that, like, there would be potential problems for her later coming back and saying, you know, inefficient counsel.
Mm-hmm.
But she was determined, and she went through so many attorneys. In fact, this was an interesting side story. Her last attorney was Daniel Horowitz, who was kind of a well-known defense attorney in Northern California. She seemed to really like him. They got through jury selection, and he had actually given opening statements. And right after that, it was a Saturday, he was in the office, and he had lunch with a friend, and he was doing some work, and he came home, and he found that his own wife had been brutally murdered it turned out to be a neighborhood boy who was kind of a drug addict and into goth, and it was just a horrific killing. Well, when that happened, the judge declared a mistrial because it would be impossible for them to carry on in Susan Polk's trial with what had just happened to her attorney, losing his wife like that in an equally awful murder issue. And then Susan, because this is how her mind works, started to think that maybe Daniel had something to do with his wife's murder. Okay. And so she kind of started to talk about, well, you know, maybe he wanted her gone. And so ultimately she fired him as well, and that was when she said, I'm going to do this myself. I'm going to represent myself, and that's that, because, you know, I want to speak for myself. And boy, was she hungry to speak for herself, because she spoke and talked and talked and talked and talked.
With all these different lawyers and then the mistrial and stuff, how long did it take actually to get this case resolved?
Well, she was arrested in 2002, and she wasn't convicted until June of 2006. So, was it 2006 or 7? Might have been 7. Sorry, I should have that in front of me. I can look it up really quick. Yeah, 2006 she was convicted. She went to trial the previous in 2005, but again, that was the one that was called a mistrial because of the defense attorney's wife being murdered. A lot of her case that she put on actually was the case that Daniel Horowitz would have put on, but she added her own special touches. For instance, Susan believed that she was psychic, and she believed that her husband was a spy for the Mossad, that he was a secret intelligence agent for the Mossad. And she believed that he would drug and rape her when she was a teenager, and that later, when she was an adult, he would put her into trances and then get her in her psychic powers to reveal certain information to him. For instance, she believed that she was the one who told her husband about 9/11, and that he had that information and that he could have warned his government, you know, he could have warned American intelligence, but that he kept it to himself. And so she was like bringing these things up in court during her testimony and through other people's testimony, and it really didn't help her case. And I think she kind of knew that. So at one point, she called a psychic to the stand to try to buttress her case that psychics are real and, you know, and she had psychic powers. But the judge really didn't allow too much from that witness, so that didn't work out for her. But, you know, it was a fascinating trial. This is the kind of stuff she put on. She put on a black belt, this very strong, tall, muscular woman who was like a black belt in some kind of martial arts style, and she had the woman talk about how when you're in a position where you think you're going to lose your life, you can gain superhuman power to overcome your attacker, because she wanted to show jurors that even though she was just the frailest looking woman they'd ever seen, it was quite possible she could have overpowered her, you know, very large, overweight, hefty husband. So, I mean, it was kind of, it was creative on her part, but in the end, she was her own worst enemy.
Do you, in a case like this, now, when you have the defendant representing him or herself, do they have or can they have, like, a co-counsel? I mean, to get an actual lawyer to give them advice as to what to do, or was she going solely on her own?
Well, she couldn't have an attorney because then, you know, she would have had an attorney. But what
right.
she did have, and which was really, I'd never seen this before, was she had a legal assistant, a woman who had no legal experience but who had spent a lot of time watching trials, just like, you know, you have, I have, a lot of your listeners have. And in fact, this was the trial where the phrase gavel groupies was created. San Francisco Chronicle reporter did a story about all the people that would show up at the trials, almost like spectator sport, and sit in the gallery and watch and talk amongst themselves and write on the Court TV message boards and blog about it. There was a woman named Valerie Harris, who had really became a true gavel groupie. And I know some people don't like that phrase, but I'm a gavel groupie. I think it's kind of accurate. You want to watch from beginning to end.
Uh-huh.
But there was a woman named Valerie Harris who started going to the Scott Peterson trial and just got hooked. And she had met Daniel Horowitz, the defense attorney there. And he kind of brought her on to help out in his office, you know, filing cabinets, you know, organizing things, just doing errands for him. And Susan Polk really liked Valerie Harris. They just kind of hit it off. So when Susan fired Daniel, she said to Valerie, but I want you to stay. I want you to help me. So here was Valerie Harris, who was, you know, really had no experience and didn't know anything about the law, and she taught herself as much as she could very quickly, and she sat with Susan every day, and she worked really hard for her, you know, running around and doing all the things that Susan couldn't do. But, you know, poor Valerie, it was like she also received the brunt of Susan Polk's ire. So every other week she would be fired and then brought back and belittled in front of the judge, and it was a thankless job.
We were talking about how probably the judge and the prosecutors didn't want her to represent herself because of possible appeal issues, among other things. But how would that work if you take someone like Susan Polk, for example, who's representing herself, and the prosecutor is examining a witness and asks a question or a line of questioning that the judge knows shouldn't be addressed, and Susan fails to object, can the judge then intervene on his own and say, I'm sorry, prosecutor, you shouldn't be asking that question? Or how does something like that play out?
Well, it's not really the judge's role to play the part of the attorney. But once in a while you would see the judge kind of raise an eyebrow. And I think that judges do that all the time. They sort of, whether or not intentional, they kind of cue the other side when they're hearing something that they think is questionable. In Susan Polk's specific case, it was never a problem because she she objected to everything. She would object to, and her objections were so creative. They were like, objection, he's harassing my son, or objection, that's a stupid question, or, and she got better and better as the trial went on, and she had these thick legal books in front of her, and she really studied them. And in fact, there were a lot of attorneys who would show up for that case to talk on the talk shows later, and they would sort of be baffled by how good she was, like, not just first-year law student good, but, like, pretty seasoned. Oh. So she really she took every opportunity to object to things that were both, questionable and things that were just rankled her. But typically I've never seen a judge ever, butt in, unless it was something so egregious that they felt compelled to, or if it was, an issue that had already been discussed and then that issue would not be brought up. And then, we would see that. But for the most part, I don't really see judges object too much.
Was there ever any talk when she still had these various attorneys of an insanity defense? Was that ever rumored or talked about?
Oh, all of them wanted her to use that as a defense. And boy, it would have really been something for her. I mean, she truly could have had a good, solid insanity defense, especially if, they got her on the stand talking about how she believed she was a psychic and that she predicted 9/11 and all these other things. But she refused. And in fact, it was part of her, it was really part of her whole defense was, I am not insane and I am not delusional and I am just defending myself. And her complaint was that it was her husband who was the sick one, who was mentally ill. And she was so smart and book smart that, you probably could, I'm sure she convinced a lot of her attorneys that, maybe she's not so. But as soon as she started turning on them and accusing them of all sorts of ridiculous things, that was when they started to see the sickness with her.
Wow.
They couldn't force her to take any kind of psychological analysis. They couldn't force that on her, and she refused to do it.
Question in the chat room. Somebody wondered if you are going to write a book on your court experiences in some of these cases.
That's a good question. And in fact, I would like to do that because I think there's a lot to be told about this kind of life, and the things that I've seen have really opened my eyes to a lot. If anyone has any thoughts about what would make an interesting chapter in that book, please email me or, share your thoughts with me, because I find this stuff fascinating. And I have been talking with my agent for, a couple of years now about how to put together a book like that. But so far it's just kind of something I'm circling but haven't dug into yet.
It would be fascinating, I bet.
Yeah, I think so. There are just so many interesting cases. And, this is, the Black Widow cases are just a whole fascinating world in themselves, and the reasons why people will turn on someone who they've spent their whole life with rather than just getting a divorce. You'll never understand that. But I think there's always a way to kind of find that moment. Like, you know, we have that in ourselves where there are moments when you think to yourself, I just can't stand this person. But, you know, but you never want to take it to the next level. But, you know, there's a moment where you kind of understand, like, oh, boy, that would just get so annoying. But, yeah.
Okay, we probably, time-wise, should move on now to the third case. And would you like to tell us about Cynthia Sommer?
Oh, yeah, I love this case. It's actually, this is a good bookend for me because Cynthia Sommer was the last trial that I covered, gavel to gavel for Court TV, as a .com reporter. And she was a really beautiful young woman, a mother of four, who lived in San Diego and was married to a Marine named Todd Sommer. And in February of 2002, Todd came home. He felt really sick. And very similar, by the way, to the antifreeze men, just, you know, fluish. He had some wine, he fell asleep in her bed, and he got up in the middle of the night and collapsed on the floor. And she was frantic, and she called 911, and she tried to give him CPR. Nothing was working. And when the ambulance came to get him, she was also in a car, you know, a patrol car with someone on the way to the hospital. Well, Todd died, and it turned out that Cynthia gained about $250,000 worth of veterans benefits from his death. Now, about a year later, the tissues, well, I should back up. She was obviously really distraught, but this is a case of a woman who grieved poorly when her husband died. With that $250,000, she did some good things. She put money aside for her kids, and there was money for her in a trust fund. But she also finally got the one thing that she always asked her husband if she could have, and he always said, not this year, not this year, we don't have enough money. Cynthia went out right away and got two new breasts. She had a breast job. And, you know, some people, when their loved one dies, they curl up in bed and they cry for, you know, months. But Cynthia wasn't like that. She wanted attention, and she wanted male attention. And she ended up kind of sleeping with a series of Marines, friends of her husband's, men who came around and, you know, helped her out and helped him watch the kids and would just kind of fix things around the house for her. She also went with her friends to Tijuana, which was right there near where they were on the border, and partied in a wet T-shirt contest with her new breasts. So, it didn't look good to Todd's parents. And, it didn't look good to prosecutors either, especially after they discovered, about a year after Todd's death, they had done some testing on his kidney tissues and liver tissues and other tissues in his body. And they found that he had more than 1,000 times the normal level of arsenic in his liver and 230 times the acceptable level in his kidneys. Well, obviously, the only person who was close enough to him all that time who could have somehow fed him arsenic was Cynthia Sommer. So she was arrested in 2005, 3 years after his death, and charged with murder. So this trial was fascinating because it was like a classic scarlet letter case, because at the end of the day, while she behaved horribly, I mean, she was a real jerk, they really had no evidence that she even knew what arsenic was. They had taken computers from the apartment. They had gone through all the purchasing records at the commissary where she shopped on base because, you know, her husband was a Marine. They looked for any kind of computer link, you know, electronic link or paper trail to show that she purchased arsenic. You know, they showed the jury that it was very easy to purchase it on eBay. It was very easy to find out information about it. But they didn't have any records to prove that she ever did any of these things. And trust me, they looked everywhere. They looked at all of her bank records, everything. So all they had were these high levels of arsenic in his body. So this was a case where the prosecutor basically called to the stand all the people who watched Cynthia, you know, show off her new breasts in Tijuana. They called a series of her former lovers to the stand and asked point blank, about each time that they had sex with her and how long after her husband's death it was. They just had all sorts of awful character testimony that proved for real that she was, you know, a real slut. But there was no proof that she knew anything about arsenic or that she had any reason to kill her husband. And in fact, you know, the money she got from his veterans benefits, she pretty much used up pretty quickly. And luckily, you know, there was a good portion of it had been put away for her kids for their college. She had four children, and one of them was with him, with Todd Summer. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful father to her kids. She really loved him. She really missed him. She took the stand, and she testified on her behalf, and she was very convincing. And she showed the jurors these tattoos that she had put on her body shortly after his death, you know, to remember him forever. But this was San Diego, which is a military town, and conservative. And all of this shocking evidence about her behavior proved really damaging to her. And the jurors, there were seven women and five men, they deliberated for about 12 hours. It was about over 2 or 3 days. And they came back guilty. And their verdict meant she would have a mandatory life without parole sentence. And I have to say, you know, you asked me earlier about cases where you kind of decide. I knew by the end of the prosecution case, when all they showed us was, okay, she, you know, she whored around and she acted really stupid, but where's the evidence? Like, I knew then that she hadn't done this, and so I was shocked when they came back with a guilty verdict. This was the kind of case that made women around the country furious. And it got a lot of play. And one of those women, and I think she lived in New York, she had a very intelligent attorney named, boyfriend named Alan Bloom. And she said to her boyfriend, Alan Bloom, you have got to help this woman. This is outrageous. This woman is going to prison for the rest of her life and won't be able to be with her kids again, you know, because she got fake breasts and because she had a little fun after her husband died. So Alan Bloom really looked into this case, and he really came to her aid, and he discovered that the first attorney had made a lot of mistakes because he really just assumed that everyone would see that there was no evidence and that Cynthia Summer was obviously innocent. Alan Bloom took it further, and he had all of the tissues re-examined, and he looked back at the original investigating organization that tested Todd's tissues. And here we get to another thing that you and I were talking about earlier, is that when Todd Summer died, the people in the hospital said to her, you know, we're really sorry about this. We need you to sign all these forms. Oh, and here's a form for you. If, you know, you can cremate his body, but, you know, we'd prefer to donate, if you would donate his tissues and organs to research. It's just a formal thing we ask everyone. And she was distraught, and she was like, yeah, I don't care. I don't care. I'll sign whatever. If she really was so smart, you know, to put him away like this, I think she would have had him cremated. She was definitely smarter than Julia Lynn Turner. But, you know, she right there signed away for them to do whatever they wanted to research his body. As it turned out, the lab that had done the testing had really inconsistent results in the arsenic test that didn't make sense. There were really, really high levels in his liver and kidney, but like minuscule in his blood, in his urine, in his brain, in other organs. And that didn't make sense because it's not like, you know, when poison goes through your body, it just like stays concentrated in one or two organs and everything else is like untouched. So, she was able to get a hearing based on her new counsel and new evidence, and they presented a lot of this new evidence, and the prosecutors went back and they retested all of the tissues, and they were unable to find arsenic.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was really problematic, and so they had to go back and decide. You know, it took a year before they tested his tissues. So what happened in between that year from when he died to when they tested? You know, nobody really knows the chain of custody. There were issues in that. So essentially, she spent like 2.5 or so years in prison for something she didn't do. And when that happened, the prosecutor, the district attorney in San Diego, moved to dismiss the charges, and that they had, they just were unable to find any evidence of arsenic, and you know, that, as they put it, justice has now been done. Well, obviously, justice was not done for Cynthia Summer, and she just yesterday, through her attorneys, announced that they're going to have a press conference tomorrow, in fact, in front of the courthouse in San Diego, where they, it looks that they're going to announce that they're going to file a civil suit, a civil complaint against the Department of the Army, the various naval medical centers that did the testing, the prosecutors, the, you know, the DA's office. And they have a pretty good case, and we'll see where it goes. But so from, you know, all of this, she's fighting back at this point.
So does anybody know for sure now how her husband died? I mean, is that, it was supposedly arsenic. Now, arsenic may not have been, can't be proved. Is it still a homicide?
No, the original notation on the cause of death on his death certificate had been cardiac arrhythmia, that he had a heart attack. You know, he was sick that day with some sort of flu-like symptoms that exacerbated an already existing heart condition. So, you know, when he got up in the middle of the night and then passed out on the floor, I mean, it's quite possible that he had had a heart attack. I think he was 23, which is really young. The sad thing is that they'll never really know exactly how he died, and his parents are still very upset. They believe that she was the killer, especially after her awful behavior. But, you know, this is a woman who didn't even know what arsenic was. I mean, the prosecution did a really interesting thing. They said, well, she could have gotten it off of eBay because we sent people out to do this, and it was very easy, and they had it delivered. Well, they had no record that she'd ever even been on eBay. And then they said, or she could have gone to the commissary and bought these ant traps. Well, her new attorney said, okay, let's take the amount of arsenic that was supposedly found in his body. How many ant traps would you have to compile to dose someone with that amount of arsenic? And it was something like, you know, 350 ant traps, and they're scraping them in the kitchen sink, scraping the poison off, and, you know, putting it in his hamburger or whatever. I mean, it was ridiculous. It was just ridiculous. So that was one of those cases where when they said guilty, my jaw dropped. And, it was so obvious that they didn't have the goods on her. And when a lot of that, honestly, was just not really effective counsel. So she had a real good reversal there, and I think a lot of us were really happy to see that she was exonerated. And
yeah,
it'll be interesting to see how the civil complaint goes.
Yeah, you really shouldn't get life in prison for being stupid. I mean, you know, or for having some new breasts put on. That probably isn't so good.
Yes.
Had she probably done a little more in the grieving department, probably none of this would have happened at all, right? I mean, it was her conduct that basically led to a lot
Absolutely.
Of the problems.
Yeah, no, it was a scarlet letter conviction. Absolutely.
We're almost out of time, Lisa. Just one quick thing. With the last time we talked, you were covering the Girl Scout murder trial. And,
right.
That, were there any surprises there with the verdict there? It was pretty much a cut and dry deal, wasn't it?
It was
no?
pretty cut and dry. Yeah, DNA evidence, you know, the very, very clear DNA evidence, and the man who had murdered the Girl Scout 30-something years earlier was finally brought to justice.
So that was a good thing, and that trial, and then, like you say, with Ms. Summer, probably justice done in that case too in the end after a while. So it's nice to see it when things work out the way they should.
Absolutely. That's the way it should work.
And in our last couple of seconds here, maybe sometime in the future we can talk about some of the celebrity cases you covered.
That would be great fun, really fun. And if anyone wants to write to me, they can find me on my website, on lisasweetingham.com. And, you know, obviously, when I'm back here again, I can't wait. It'll be really a good thing.
Well, thank you very much, Lisa. It was very enjoyable and very interesting cases. And we'll be in touch about doing something in the future.
Thanks, Denny. Take care.
Okay, good night now. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Until next time, have a great evening.